Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The city of Richmond, California, is making national headlines for Mayor Gail McLaughlin's plan to use eminent domain to deal with the foreclosure crisis. Eminent domain is synonymous with public seizure laws to displace residents and communities to make way for things like highways, shopping malls, and more recently, to make room for the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. But the plan in Richmond is to buy underwater mortgages, and the investors would be paid some of what they're owed, and the homeowner would receive a new mortgage. But if the investors don't agree to this plan, Mayor McLaughlin says she might use eminent domain to seize the mortgages at fair market value. Wells Fargo and Deutsche Bank have sued the city and have threatened to stop giving credit to cities that use eminent domain to rescue residents with underwater mortgages. Investors, realtors, and land title companies say the plan is unconstitutional. So on today's Your Call, we continue our agenda for a new economy series by talking about community solutions to the foreclosure crisis, which is still affecting millions of homeowners. How serious are the legal and economic challenges to the eminent domain plan? Also, Mayor McLaughlin says if enough cities in California and across the country embrace this concept, it might force lenders and investors to reduce the amount that borrowers owe. So what do you want to know about this plan, and do you think other cities will follow suit? Do you think they should? Today, we're joined by David Sharples. He's local director for the Contra Costa Alliance for Californians for Community Empowerment. It's a statewide nonprofit that does community organizing and social justice work in low-income communities. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, great to have you. So give us an update. This is receiving national headlines. It hasn't gone into effect yet, but where does this plan to use eminent domain stand right now?
So the City Council of Richmond recently in September, they passed forward, they voted to move forward with the program, and they are looking into forming a joint powers authority with other cities around the state in order to move forward with the program to use eminent domain to seize mortgages in order to restructure those mortgages and reduce the principal.
And Oakland officials have discussed this. Mayor McLaughlin says she's been talking with officials in San Francisco and a number of small cities in Southern California about this joint power authority. So if officials in those cities agree, how would that work?
So basically, the cities would come together, and it would be the joint powers authority that would be exercising the use of eminent domain rather than the city of Richmond. So it's basically a structure, a legal structure that allows the cities to come together and use the eminent domain power.
And obviously it would give these cities more power, right, if they're doing it together rather than on their own?
Right, correct, yep.
And so can you talk a little bit about how eminent domain would actually work? Because when we read about eminent domain, the first thing comes to mind is that residents might be displaced for things like shopping malls, and we're now seeing residents displaced because of the Keystone XL pipeline. So how would eminent domain work in this case?
Yeah, that's right. In the past, it's been used, you know, when they built the 580, for example, people were pushed out and given pennies on the dollar for their homes, and especially communities of color were negatively affected by the use of eminent domain. In this case, we think the use of eminent domain could do exactly the opposite. It could be used to help keep families in their homes.
How exactly would it work? So let's say, for example, I bought my home for $200,000 and now I owe $400,000. How would that help me?
So basically, the city would use its eminent domain authority to seize the loan, not the house and the property, actually the mortgage. So just like when Wells Fargo sells a mortgage to Auckland, which happens all the time, in this case, the city would seize the mortgage, and the people who own that mortgage would be given fair market value, but it would the ownership of that mortgage would be transferred to who we would consider a good actor, who's then willing to restructure the mortgage and reduce the principal on that. So, like, if someone owes $400,000 and their house is only worth $200,000, in that case, the value of that mortgage would be reduced down to $200,000. And so that would help the person a lot, because we know in a lot of cases people who are you know, extremely underwater are much more likely to go into default and end up in foreclosure, which causes a lot of problems.
And so who exactly would be involved in this process?
Well, so there's an outside investor group who's working with the city called Mortgage Resolution Partners, and so they would be arranging the financing. And so the city would actually be the one that uses its eminent domain authority, and then this outside investor group would provide the financing and pay the owners of the mortgages, which are big asset management firms like PIMCO and BlackRock are some of the owners of the mortgages. They would get paid off with the fair market value, and then there would be a new owner of the mortgage and a new servicer who would continue to work with the homeowner.
And so this Mortgage Resolution Partners, this is a San Francisco-based group of financiers, and they've been calling on a number of cities for more than a year to use government powers of eminent domain. And then the main argument behind this, or against this, I should say, by Wells Fargo and Deutsche Bank, they've both filed a lawsuit acting on behalf of investors who hold these loans. They say that the plan is illegal because it's a scheme to reap windfall profits for Mortgage Resolution Partners. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, we would say that they are the people who own the mortgages are going to be given fair market value based on an independent assessment of the value of those mortgages. MRP, they do stand to make profits. They are a for-profit enterprise, and we think there's nothing wrong with that as long as they're going to help people, get principal reduction and keep families in their home. We don't have a problem with them making some amount of money, but we don't think that the owners of the mortgages are going to be unduly harmed. We think they're going to get the fair market value for those mortgages.
We're speaking with David Sharples. He's local director for Contra Costa Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. And we're talking about the plan in Richmond to use eminent domain to help homeowners who have underwater mortgages. And this plan is getting national attention. So far, Wells Fargo and Deutsche Bank have sued. A judge recently tossed the lawsuit, saying it was premature because Richmond has not used and might never use its power of eminent domain to seize mortgages. But the ruling does not prevent the banks from refiling the lawsuit if the city does invoke that power. And the mayor says if other cities join in, they might have more power to force lenders to reduce the amount that borrowers owe. So what do you want to know about this plan? What do you think of it? And do you think other cities should step in and embrace eminent domain to help homeowners? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We did a foreclosure show just a couple of weeks ago, and we actually had full lines because so many of you are dealing with this issue. So if you want to share your story and talk about how you are dealing with foreclosure, if your city has any other creative solution, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And David, can you talk about just what Californians are facing right now? I mean, where are foreclosures in October 2013?
So, I mean, you read a lot in the paper about the housing prices are going up and, you know, the foreclosure crisis is over. And that may be true in places like San Francisco, where the housing prices have gone back up even above the bubble, you know, record highs. But in places like Richmond, where you have working class neighborhoods, people are still dramatically underwater. So lots of people are, you know, their homes are worth $200,000 and they owe $400,000, for example. So, and the problem with that is we know that a high percentage of those folks who are underwater, dramatically underwater, are going to end up in default. And so unless something is done to deal with this underwater crisis, and what we would think is the right solution would be principal reduction, then you're going to see hundreds of thousands of more mortgages hundreds of thousands of more foreclosures across the country, which has a devastating impact on neighborhoods. It causes blight, which brings down the value of all the houses around it. Every time a house goes into foreclosure in Richmond, we know that the city loses out on about $20,000 in lost property tax revenue and increased cost of maintenance and policing and code enforcement. So it really has a huge impact on our neighborhoods.
The cities are also taking a chance by embracing eminent domain because the bond rating agency Standard & Poor's said it would lower ratings for cities that use eminent domain. Does this concern you at all?
They have not lowered the bond rating for Richmond. So Wall Street has been making a lot of threats. Hmm. To try to stop Richmond from moving forward with this. They've said that if Richmond moves forward, they would not make loans in Richmond anymore, which is essentially redlining, and there's laws against that. Banks cannot get together and agree to boycott a city and not make loans in that city. That's a violation of antitrust laws. So, and there's attorneys, public interest law firms out there who have already stood up and said if banks did do that, where they refused to make loans in Richmond, they would file suit against those banks for redlining. And so it's really ridiculous, though, because Richmond was originally targeted by banks with predatory bad loans, so interest-only loans, adjustable rate mortgages, targeting people who should have gotten good fixed rate loans with bad loans. Richmond is a majority minority city. It's 40% Latino and 25% African American. So it was targeted with predatory loans, back before the crash. And now that finally the city has come up with its own local solution to deal with this problem and help keep families in their homes, and now Wall Street banks are saying they're targeting Richmond again and saying if you move forward with this, we won't make any loans in your city. Mm. So it's a matter of, Wall Street needs to get out of the way and let Richmond use its local power to fix this problem. Because Wall Street and the federal government have done nothing to help homeowners.
We're speaking with David Sharples, local director for Contra Costa Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. And let's take a few of our callers. Let's hear from Carol in San Francisco. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to say that I believe that this is capitalism at its very best, creative capitalism. And it gladdens me, whether it's a profit or a nonprofit who's come up with this idea to use eminent domain for humane reasons rather than kicking people out and just willy-nilly, sending them on their way. I think this is fabulous, and I applaud everyone involved in this.
Do you think San Francisco should embrace this?
I think the entire country should embrace this.
Well, thank you for calling. David, have you heard from other cities? The mayor, Gail McLaughlin of Richmond, has been in touch with other mayors. Do you know if other mayors are going to embrace this plan?
Yeah, so, there's cities across the country that are looking at this. So Seattle, Newark, New Jersey, here in California, El Monte, in Minnesota, there's a city that's looking at doing this. So there's a lot of interest around the country by people who, want to deal with this problem of the underwater crisis. And they're looking closely at what happens in Richmond and hopeful that they can move forward with it as well.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Carol. And let's go next to Matthew in San Francisco. Hi, Matthew.
Good morning, Rose. Thank you. I just wanted to mention two things in terms of this concept, which is wonderful, and it's great that we have it in our tool chest, and kind of remind us that we're not really cutting edge, because the Europeans, who have also been suffering and continue to suffer with their real estate bubble bursting as a result of lending practices, the Europeans have mandated that the banks do principal write-downs. For instance, in Hungary, the law will become effective November 1st, but it's not the only one. But in any event, and if the banks do not principal write-downs to enable the property owners to keep their homes, then the state will mandate it and force them to do so. And secondly, in terms of the defense of Wells Fargo and Deutsche Bank and their complaint are alleging, really is not appropriate, in as much as these loans that, and especially impoverished areas such as Richmond or in the Valley, all were recourse loans. In other words, the original lenders, when these loans were tranched up in these CDOs and marketed in groups, the individual loans had recourse. Any individual lender or pension fund or individual investors would have recourse and get a return of their that are kind of leading the charge to prevent Richmond and other municipalities from using this really great.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. And David, I know we have to let you go, but before we do, what about other creative solutions that you're seeing across the country? Are any other politicians embracing anything like this to help homeowners?
You know, we pushed hard on our California Attorney General, Kamala Harris, last year to do this settlement with the banks to get them to do more principal reduction. And as a result of that, we've seen more principal reduction in California, but not enough. And we want, you know, we know that we need to see more principal reduction in order to deal with this problem. I mean, we think that principal reduction is the main solution that we need in order to deal with this crisis, because so many people are profoundly underwater. And what that means is it's a real drag on our overall economy, because when people's mortgage payments are sky high, then they can't afford to spend in local businesses. And if their payments were reduced, they'd be able to go out, spend in local businesses, which would help create jobs and would help stimulate our economy. So we really think that these banks need to do more principal reduction, and our federal government and our president needs to push them to do more principal reduction.
Well, and it's kind of amazing when you think about the fact that nearly 10 million homeowners, or 20% of households with mortgages, they continue to owe more on their home loans than their homes are now worth. So it's, why aren't we seeing more cities exploring alternative options?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, if Richmond is able to succeed and move forward with this solution, then you'll see a lot more cities around the country move forward. And I know that, you know, folks in Seattle and Newark, New Jersey, and El Monte are excited to move forward with it and hopeful that they can.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, David.
Thank you.
David Sharples is local director for Contra Costa Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. They do community organizing and social justice work in low-income communities. And today we are talking about Mayor Miguel McLaughlin's plan. She's the mayor of Richmond, California, to use eminent domain to deal with the foreclosure crisis. And now I would like to welcome Marilyn Langlois to the show. Marilyn is on the steering committee of the Richmond Progressive Alliance. She's community advocate in Mayor McLaughlin's office, and she ran for city council in 2012. Hi, Marilyn. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Hi.
So thanks for joining us. So it's interesting because, you know, this plan is receiving national headlines. And what is the status of it right now? Because the mayor says that the plan is to buy 624 underwater mortgages. The investors would be paid some of what they're owed. The homeowner would receive a new mortgage. And if the investor doesn't agree to this plan, that's when she might step in and use eminent domain.
Sure. First of all, let me just make one slight correction. I was on the staff of Mayor McLaughlin as a community advocate in her office until April of 2012. I'm no longer in that position since I moved into the electoral politics myself and was a candidate last year, and I'm currently no longer on the city staff. I do serve on a city commission. That said, I still work very closely with the mayor through the Richmond Progressive Alliance, which is a grassroots group that has been supporting this initiative from the outset. We work very closely with ACE, Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, and we're very excited to see this moving forward. So the way things stand now, we're currently, and I'm not sure how much David already said earlier in the program, but we are currently in the process of putting on the pressure for the holders of these underwater mortgages to negotiate with the city. That is by far and away our preferred method of moving forward, is to negotiate a fair price so that the city can purchase these mortgages, refinance them, keep people in their homes at a reduced principal so that the neighbors, you know, for all the reasons David said, I think I heard him say that at the end. And so that's where we're standing right now. So far, the owners of the mortgages and their, you know, agents have declined to negotiate. So we're putting up the pressure. We're going to be going to San Francisco tomorrow to stand in front of BlackRock, calling on them to work with us. And we're, you know, going on a lot of different fronts. So the actual vote on the eminent domain process has not happened. It's not something that the mayor can unilaterally impose. There's a whole process for eminent domain. It has to go through the city council, get a supermajority of the council vote. There has to be advance notice. There needs to be legal opinions as to what the fair prices are and all that sort of thing. So that process has not yet commenced.
And what are you hearing from citizens?
What we're hearing from citizens is really, this is a refreshing idea to deal with something that's been a very persistent problem in Richmond ever since 2008, when we were hit really hard by the foreclosure crisis. Our neighborhoods have suffered really terribly, and a lot of homeowners have already lost their homes because of this. And people were already outraged when they saw the Wall Street banks being bailed out a few years ago, saying they're too big to fail. But ordinary people in communities were not helped at all. And people that we talk to see this as a really good way to hold the banks accountable, to find a solution that is going to really help the neighborhoods, and it's going to, you know, stabilize the market and in the long run be good for investors who are interested in socially responsible investing.
And we're speaking with Marilyn Langlois. She's on the steering committee of the Richmond Progressive Alliance. And just quickly before we go to break, what does the conversation sound like between the city of Richmond and other cities? Are other cities calling the mayor's office to find out how she's planning to go about this?
There have been various lines of communication with a number of other cities. I believe the two main ones that have come up recently, or early on actually, are El Monte in Southern California, also Seattle, Newark, New Jersey, Minneapolis, St. Paul, San Francisco and Oakland. I know the mayor has been in touch with Supervisor Avalos in San Francisco. So, you know, there's just a lot of conversations going on back and forth, and each city, of course, has its own mechanism for making the determination. Usually it has to be voted on by, you know, city
right.
council.
And we're going to take a quick break. What do you want to know about using eminent domain to help people stay in their homes? And if you've been successful in renegotiating your loan with your bank, we'd love to hear from you. We'll be back after this.
Your call is always better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's program, call 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or just leave a message at the website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about how genetically engineered crops are affecting the environment. A federal judge in Mexico recently banned genetically engineered corn, saying it was an imminent threat to the environment. And Kauai's city council passed a law requiring agricultural companies to disclose which pesticides and genetically modified crops they're testing. Up until now, this has been secret information. So what does the science tell us about how GMO crops affect the environment and our food supply? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the ongoing foreclosure crisis. Foreclosure started peaking during the first 3 months of 2009. In California, there were 135,000 default notices. And then from July to September of this year, there were over 20,000 default notices. Richmond Mayor Gail McLaughlin says if the banks do not take any action, she might use eminent domain to seize mortgages at fair market value. And as you can imagine, the banks oppose this, investors, land title companies, they all say the plan is unconstitutional. So we're talking about how this would work. If you have any questions about eminent domain or want to share your thoughts on it, as we just heard, a number of cities are calling the city of Richmond to find out how they're going to go about this. And then also, if you have been underwater and you've successfully renegotiated your loan, we'd love to hear your story, or maybe you haven't been successful. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Today, we're joined by Marilyn Langlois. She's on the steering committee of the Richmond Progressive Alliance. She was a community advocate in the office of Mayor McLaughlin, and she ran for city council in 2012. And now I would like to welcome Robert Hockett to the show. Robert is professor of law at Cornell University's Law School. He conducts research in the fields of financial law and economics, particularly as they relate to economic globalization and inequality. The plan to use eminent domain to save neighborhoods was conceived by Robert and his colleagues at the time of the housing crash back in 2007-2008. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's great to have you. So how did you come up with this plan in 2007-2008?
There were a few of us who were sort of thinking along similar lines then, and basically the way we came up with this is we noted that as soon as housing prices crashed, so that basically lots of home loans were underwater, banks that actually held loans that they could control were actually writing down many of those loans, because it's actually good for the creditor as well as for the debtor to write them down under such circumstances, because they're subject to enormous default risk unless you do write them down. But what we noticed that was that although these portfolio loan holding banks were doing this, a certain class of loans were not being written down. This was the class known as the private label securitized loans, or PLS loans. Those were not being written down in nearly the same numbers, even though the financial logic was the same. There was just as much reason to write those down. It would be just as creditor benefiting and debtor benefiting as were the write downs in the case of the bank loans, and yet it wasn't happening. So the question was why, and we noticed that there were a number of very important impediments that prevented those from being written down, and almost all of them were embodied in the contracts pursuant to which those loans were securitized, the contracts pursuant to which those PLS loans were securitized. And eminent domain is a very well-known tool, at least to lawyers, that's used by government instrumentalities to get past contracts that are no longer functional.
So how do you explain inaction by the banks on this issue?
The real key point that one has to remember about the banks here is that they wear three or four different hats. They have multiple different roles. So insofar as the bank is actually the owner of a particular loan, the banks actually do write those loans down in higher numbers than the PLS loans get written down. And indeed, they boast about it, right? So Wells Fargo, even in the middle of the lawsuit against Richmond, was claiming that it writes down loans. The problem is that even if it's true that Wells Fargo is writing down loans insofar as it owns loans and it has the right to write them down, Wells Fargo also plays three or four additional roles, and in those roles, it's actually standing in the way. And the reason, basically, is because in those other roles, it's faced with a conflict of interest. So first, Wells Fargo and other banking institutions are servicers of securitized loans. That's to say that they are the institutions that collect the loan payments from the borrowers then give pass those payments along to the securitization trust, which then disperse the funds to the bondholders. The key point here is that in your role as a servicer, you're actually paid more money when a loan goes into delinquency, right? When the loan becomes troubled, you're paid extra. That means that banking institutions enjoy a significant revenue line that comes their way in their roles as servicers on troubled securitized loans. So, of course, they don't want to see those securitized loans written down, because if they cease to go delinquent, then the banks cease to get that revenue. But, of course, it wouldn't be very noble. It wouldn't sell well. It wouldn't play well in Peoria, so to speak, to say, I'm against something that stops foreclosures because I benefit by loan delinquencies. That would be a bit like a doctor saying, I'm against a cure for cancer because I make a lot of money from ongoing cancer payments. So what they do instead is they pretend to be objecting to the plan in their role as bondholder or in their role as investor. But that's not really the case. The other role that they play, that's a key one here, is they often hold second liens on particular homes. That's to say that they basically have second dibs on a home that they can, you know, attach or foreclose on in the event that a particular borrower has taken out a so-called home equity line of credit from those banks. And they don't, they're afraid of that they might lose in their roles as second lien holders, because they know that eminent domain in the future could be used to take second liens in addition to being used to take the loans. And because they're afraid of that prospect, and because they enjoy significant holdup power over debtors by dint of these second liens, they're trying to prevent the loss of that particular power.
And before we go to calls, we've got full lines. How do you explain the lack of movement in cities, or the lack, like politicians haven't really stepped up to the plate, like someone like Mayor McLaughlin, to help homeowners at a time when bank CEOs are, I mean, their pay is just off the charts. I'm reading an article right now, bank CEOs gain as millions lose their dream. Mm-hmm. This was last year in the Star Ledger. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they point out that Bank of America's CEO Brian Moynihan's pension assets now total $6.8 million. The pension assets of Wells Fargo CEO John Stump stand at $16 million. The profits are off the chart. Credit Suisse CEO Brady Duncan got a 34% pay increase, $8.2 million. So, I mean, you see these just million-dollar numbers that are kind of hard to imagine as people still suffer, and not much has been done. How do you explain that?
Well, I think it's basically, you can explain it by reference to the same facts that make it the case that Gail McLaughlin is a national hero. And what I mean, and I really do mean that, I actually think Richmond is going to be to this movement in future what Selma, Alabama proved to be to the civil rights movement. Basically, any time a city moves in this particular way, all of the industry groups, all of those gentlemen you mentioned with their million-dollar-plus pensions, train all of their guns on those cities and attack those cities. They demonize them. They spread disinformation about the nature of the plan. They threaten to withdraw credit from the cities. They file frivolous lawsuits against them in order to harass them. They lobby with federal regulators to get them to try to clamp down on the cities. And so you have to have a lot of backbone, at least to be the first city to do this. Now, ultimately, when multiple cities start doing it, and we are poised to do that, as I know you know, at that point, one won't have to be quite as bold as a single city or a single city leader to do that. But at the present juncture, right, look at what happened to San Bernardino when they stepped up to the plate first back in May, June of 2012. They were just attacked mercilessly until 6 months later they decided they had to take a time out. Same thing happened to Brockton, Massachusetts. Same thing happened to Chicago. So ultimately, you needed one or both of two things to happen. You either needed a very, very bold, a very brave, a hard-fighting a city leader or city leadership so that one city could actually step up to the plate and withstand all of those guns being fixed or trained on that one first head that popped up above the trenches, or you had to get multiple cities acting at the same time on this. As it happens, we kind of have both. We do have a first city. It's Richmond. And again, it took a very bold leadership from Gail McLaughlin and from her city council to do this. But we also have a lot of other cities that are about to join the effort. And Richmond knows basically that it's not alone now. That's largely thanks to the work of Amy Schur and ACE and other groups. And so nationwide, we've got a movement that's really come to full fruition at this point. And I think we're going to see a significant change now. I think more and more cities will actually be acting on this now.
And Marilyn, it's pretty telling that default notices remain more prevalent in California's least expensive neighborhoods, low-income neighborhoods where subprime lending was prevalent.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. The housing crisis hit throughout the nation in 2008, And in the 5 years since then, in a lot of places, the home values have started coming back up. Neighborhoods have become more stable, but not in Richmond. Our home prices, our home values are still very low. We still have a lot of foreclosures, blighted neighborhoods, and it tends to be areas with low to moderate income, hardworking families that have really suffered from this.
Well, we've got full lines, so let's hear from our next caller. Maurice Weeks is calling from ACE, the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. Hi, Maurice. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
So I understand you're issuing a report today about Wells Fargo.
We are, yes. So folks know we've been involved with a long campaign against Wells Fargo in a number of different areas, including our local principal reduction work, which you guys have just been speaking at length about. In situations when Wells Fargo is unable to exert their influence, it's with really strong politicians. It really works like it has in Richmond. But all over California, they've actually been taking their profits and using their checkbook to exert influence in our legislature and stop really important progressive bills and funnel donations into different politicians throughout the state. So we're releasing a report today along with Public Campaign, who is an organization that does a lot of research on political donations, about just how much Wells Fargo was spending on those donations throughout California and what that that total amount of money is buying them in terms of legislation and policy.
Have you seen banks spending more money in the state of California over the last 5 years?
Yes, absolutely. Wells Fargo, and they're obviously the largest mortgage servicer in the country, but they spend the largest amount of money here than they spend in any other state. It's their home state. They spend about 25% of all of their political donations here in California. And we also see, as legislators like California try to work their way out of the economic and housing crisis, with different pieces of progressive legislation that might raise revenue or attempt to halt foreclosures, the amount of donations that Wells Fargo funnels into the legislature spikes every time that happens.
And
so as the housing crisis hit, Wells Fargo's donations spiked as well.
And I'm assuming this goes to Republicans and Democrats. Can you name maybe two politicians at the top who receive the most money from Wells Fargo or just the banks in general in California?
Well, the report's being released today at 4, so I don't want to give too much information, but I will cite one politician, Mimi Walters of Irvine, who was a staunch opponent of the Homeowner Bill of Rights, which folks might know is pretty landmark legislation here in California to help stop foreclosures and beat back banks beating up homeowners, and is also one of the people who's most opposed to any sort of measure that raises revenue in California. And she is the largest, she receives the largest amount of money out of any sitting politician from Wells Fargo.
Is she a Democrat or a Republican?
She's a Republican from Irvine.
Okay, you know, we should do a show about this. So, thank you.
I would love to be back on to talk about it. So the report's being released today. There are a couple of actions around the state at 4 p.m. So folks can visit calorganize.org to see the report after 4 o'clock today. And I'd love to be back on to talk in more detail about it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Robert,
we know that the banks give a lot of money to politicians in Washington. In fact, I think it was Dick Durbin who said the banks own the place. Mm-hmm. But what about their influence at the state level?
They have a significant level at the, influence at the state level as well in a number of different ways. So sometimes it's a tiny bit more subtle in the sense that they don't buy regulators or they don't buy or procure regulation in the way that they do in D.C. But they have other ways, right? One is, of course, they make lots of contributions, lots of campaign contributions. Another is that they can often threaten to withdraw credit availability to cities that do things that they don't like or that, to states that they don't like. Another thing they can do is a kind of a variation on that theme. They have a lot of influence with certain federal regulators, and notably the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the FHFA, which is probably best known in virtue of the positions taken by its acting director, Ed DeMarco, who opposes principal reduction. And what the bankers are often able to do is to get FHFA to threaten to prevent the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, from extending credit to particular cities or particular states that adopt policies that they don't like. So they managed to get rid of an anti-predatory lending law that they didn't like in Georgia back in 2006 by using FHFA as a kind of tool, as a lever. They managed to stop Chicago from penalizing people, banks that held foreclosed homes that they didn't maintain, so the property would go to ruin in parts of Chicago. Chicago passed an ordinance to penalize them for that, and FHFA, at the behest of the banks, clamped down on Chicago and said that we're going to deny you the kind of credit that flows from Fannie and Freddie if you do that. So they work that way as well. And then finally, the third or fourth way, depending on how we're counting, is they often will finance astroturfing campaigns and robocalling campaigns and false and disinformation spreading mailing campaigns to prevent certain ordinances from passing or to prevent certain state initiatives from getting onto ballots or from winning at the ballots. And indeed, we've seen this recently out in North Las Vegas, Nevada, and we've seen it out in Richmond, where they actually, you know, spread flyers. They finance the spreading of flyers that say things like, don't let Richmond take our homes. And of course, the plan has never been to take the home. It's to take the loans, but they'll spread the disinformation because they don't really care whether the truth gets out. What they really want is, you know, to get their way. They want the result that they want. So there are all those kinds of methods that they can use, and they've got lots of money to do it. Well, finally, the other one I didn't mention is, again, sort of harassing lawsuits, like the one that we saw filed on August 7th against Richmond that was, you know, happily dismissed.
Well, I'm glad when my memory actually works, because it was Senator Dick Durbin who said in 2009 that the banks, quote, frankly own the place. He's a senator from Illinois.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you for calling in. And let's go next to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you very, very much. I wanted to throw out as a question/solution. And the question would be, when a while back, and I don't know, Rose, if you did a show on it, when there was the big movement to move your money from the big banks to the smaller community banks?
Yes, we've done several shows on that.
Okay, so, and I did do that. I mean, I live in El Cerrito, which is a neighboring, Richmond's right next door. It's on my border. And I did move my bank to Mechanics Bank, which is a small community bank. They're wonderful. My question is, are the smaller community banks getting, you know, hit with this eminent domain stuff and the buying out the mortgages and all of that? Because I hadn't heard that. I love my bank, and I was going to suggest to listeners as a way of steering clear of Wells Fargo and Bank of America, I wanted to endorse again the move your money to the smaller community banks. And I know that Mechanics Bank does do home loans and car loans and, you know, school loans and everything else like that. I just hadn't heard if they were brought up in this whole mortgage controversy.
No, that's a good question. Marilyn, do you think, I mean, how is it a good idea to move your money? Does it make a difference? And how can we find out if a small bank was involved in any of this?
Sure. You know, we've supported the Move Your Money. We have Mechanics Bank, local community bank. We also have a few local credit unions that many people have switched to. In terms of this particular program, it is designed to purchase mortgages that are, as the professor mentioned, PLS, private label securities. That is mortgages that have been bought up by other entities, sliced and diced, and turned into mortgage-backed securities. That's very different from the type of home loans that banks like Mechanics Bank and other community banks issue. They issue mortgages in the old-fashioned way, and they hold them, and they have that relationship with the homeowner, and the homeowner pays their mortgage payment to the local bank, and those types of mortgages will not be affected at all by this program.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ruth Ann. And just quickly, Robert, since you closely study these issues, what do you think of the Move Your Money campaigns? Do they make a difference?
They can make a big difference. I mean, I should actually disclose that I'm part of that campaign in another sort of parallel involvement of my own. If your listeners Google the name the Occupy Money Cooperative, or just TOMC, they'll see that there's a particular kind of a nationwide credit union-like banking institution that I and a number of colleagues who were on the Alternative Banking Committee of the Occupy Wall Street movement back in 2011 have just started. And our whole point is to try to get people to move their money into more community bank-like institutions in the way that we once did. So I do think it's definitely worthwhile. And for the reasons just stated, right, I mean, these kinds of institutions used to dominate home lending. And when they did, home lending was perfectly functional. It worked well. You didn't have nationwide housing price bubbles and busts of the kind that we're going through now. what really made a nationwide housing price bubble and bust of the kind that we've just gone through possible in significant part was this move to the so-called originate-to-distribute model, which is essentially mortgage loan securitization, where people actually extend loans not with the intention of hanging on to them and then servicing them, but with the intention of selling them then to somebody else, like a securitization trust, and then getting, you know, investment money from bondholders. That model made credit, I would argue, much too cheap in certain places, and also, of course, made it more possible to engage in predatory lending practices of the kind that really fueled the bubble. So moving to the community banking model is important in its own right for a lot of different reasons. The housing price bubble and bust is one of them, but there are more reasons than that as well.
That's Robert Hockett. He's professor of law at Cornell University's Law School. The plan to use eminent domain to save homeowners was conceived by Robert and his colleagues at the time of the housing crash in 2007. And we are also joined today by Marilyn Langlois. She's on the steering committee of the Richmond Progressive Alliance. She ran for city council in 2012. And thanks again for calling, Ruthann. Let's go next to Mark in Oakland. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. This is sort of an emotional issue for me because I've always wanted to own a home. You know, I'm in my mid-50s. I make like $55,000 a year. There's no way I could buy a place. But now that I see these people that rolled the dice back when the houses were going sky high, they bought a piece of property they know they couldn't afford. Now they're going to make out because their homes are going to be reappraised. They're going to get a payment they can afford. And at the end of the day, they'll still have their piece of property. You know, 50 years ago, a house wasn't an investment vehicle. It wasn't a so-called tulip. It was just something that you would pay off in 30 years, and then you'd have something. Now it's an investment opportunity. And so for a person like me, I'm just still stuck as a renter.
Hmm.
So now I don't want the banksters to make out here, and I feel sorry for the people that have these payments. But, you know, when you buy a car, it loses money too. And nobody's rushing in and saying, I need my car reappraised because it's not worth as much as it was before.
You know, and so, yeah, Mark, stay on the line because we've done a lot of shows about this. We've talked a lot about buyer's loans, how, you know, people were given AAA ratings when they shouldn't have received them, or when
right.
their salary was changed and they didn't know about it. But, you know, I stay on the line. Robert, what are your thoughts on Mark's comments?
Yeah, I understand the gist of the comment, but the thing is, I think that Mark might be assuming something that's just not true, right? There's a false premise in the comment. And that is that the overwhelming majority of people who are now in trouble were actually speculative buyers. And it's just not the case. There were definitely some speculative buyers, but the key point about a bubble, anytime you have a credit-fueled asset price bubble, it's basically like a hyperinflation. It's like basically real. It's like inflation on steroids. And what that means in turn is that the market price is way, way, way high, and people who want to buy a home thus have to pay a very high price. So if you're going to buy a home at all, you got to pay the market price. You can't, as an individual, say, I'm not willing to pay that price. Because if you do, right, everybody else will pay the price, and it will go ahead and sell to somebody else. So you got to pay the market price. And when credit is cheap, or when it's predatorily extended in the way that it was during the bubble years, you think, well, I got to pay the market price, but happily I can borrow to do that at least. And indeed, I can borrow cheaply because credit is now available cheaply. And everybody tells me that the prices of the houses can only go up, so I'm not really going to lose on this in the long run. So I'll go ahead and do it. And then, of course, the values of the houses suddenly plummet when everything crashes, and then people are way underwater. And the analogy to a car's losing value is not actually helpful in this particular context, because the point is, with a house, people often expect to be able to refinance housing loans when interest rates change, or people expect to be able to sell a house and move someplace else if they get a better job offer someplace else. But when a house is way underwater, you can't do that. So you're sort of stuck in the house and in the neighborhood, in the locality, even if there are no jobs there. You're stuck there as long as the house is underwater, and there's no sort of analogous lock-in in the case of cars. So to sum up, again, while I think Mark's point is right of some people, right, there are always some people who are just speculative, profligate types, or there's some people who are, you know, just sort of crazy or silly or criminal or merely speculative. That's a very tiny minority, and the overwhelming majority of those who are in trouble right now are just perfectly innocent people like Mark who had to pay the market price when it was too high because it was a bubble.
Well, all right. Well, thank you again for calling, Mark. We're almost out of time. Marilyn, final thoughts from you. What's going to happen in Richmond if investors don't agree to this initial plan set out by Mayor McLaughlin about buying 624 underwater mortgages? Investors would be paid some of what they're owed, and then homeowners would receive a new mortgage.
Right. Well, we're very optimistic moving forward. As I said, we're still putting a lot of pressure on many of the financial asset companies to come to the table and negotiate with the city. We see this as something that's going to happen down the road anyway, so we're working on that negotiation process. We're also setting up a joint powers agreement to bring other cities into the mix. And when we get to the point of actually starting the eminent domain process, we will be working with the community members, talking with our city council members to make sure we can get the 5 votes on the city council that would be necessary to begin the eminent domain process. And, right now we're also doing workshops and community meetings to inform people about the program, because as Professor Hockett said, there is a PR campaign being put out there by Wall Street banks to spread misinformation in the community. We're trying to correct that information. We're also working right now on setting up a meeting with our member of Congress, George Miller. We'd like to sit down and talk with him and try to get his public support for this process, and also his support in urging the FHFA to back off on its threats to withhold loans and loan insurance, mortgage insurance on communities who engage this. As you can imagine, we consider this to be would be blatant redlining. If a resident of Richmond qualifies for an FHA loan in every other way, they should get that FHA loan and not be punished just because of, you know, whatever other legal action their city has taken on another area. So,
all right, and so we'll put information about this on our website. And again, there's going to be a meeting in San Francisco tomorrow. So if you live in San Francisco, you might want to get involved in this. Marilyn Langlois is on the steering committee of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, and Robert Hockett is a professor of law at Cornell University's Law School. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How are genetically engineered crops impacting the environment? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about 2 recent GMO bans. A federal judge in Mexico recently banned genetically engineered corn, saying it was an imminent threat to the environment. And Kauai's city council passed a law requiring agricultural companies to disclose which pesticides and modified crops they're testing. GMO crops are grown widely in the U.S., so what does the science tell us about their effects? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.